Where were you living when you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
I was living about 17 miles west of Irene, South Dakota, on a farm. And I heard it about noon that day on our little radio we had. And the day was, I remember that day so well. It was a clear day. There was no snow on the ground. And I, an old Model A, I went hunting jackrabbits in the afternoon. And that evening, I drove over to Scotland. A bunch of us young people went to Minnow, and we went roller skating.
So you went roller skating
And
that
that
night.
night, a Sunday night, that was on a Sunday.
Now, did you enlist or were you drafted?
I was drafted.
And what year, what month?
I was drafted in 1942. In September is when I left for service.
Okay. Now you told me you were in Merrill's Marauders. Could you for those unfamiliar with Merrill's Marauders, could you describe that outfit, what branch of the army, what theater it was in, and your commanding officer?
It was it was my outfit was slapped together up in Quebec, Canada, by our president. And Mountbatten from England, and they wanted a, they tried to get an outfit put together that would get behind the lines in Burma against the Japs. The Japs had Burma pretty much, and they were afraid the Japs were going to come into India. So they wanted, and the Chinese was already in there, and the Chinese weren't making much progress. Let Japs come, wouldn't push them back. So they wanted this outfit to go in behind the lines and harass them back in the jungle. And then the Chinese could make a push. Then they'd get pushed as we got their attention back there. And this was an all-volunteer outfit. There was 1,000 people from the islands, experienced people against the Japs, and there was 1,000 people from the United States, and there was another 1,000 from the Caribbean down in there. That joint, we us three, it was made up of 3 battalions. We never was full strength. We're about 2,800. Each battalion has 1,000 men in it. It's supposed to be 3,000. But we wound up leaving with about 2,800, and we had pack horses and mules.
Who was the commanding officer of
Oh,
Merrill's Marauders?
General Merrill.
And he was the United States general.
Yeah, he was from the United States, but he came from China. Had a tour over there, and that's where he came from to command our outfit.
And what was your impression of General Mello? Did you actually get to meet him in person?
Yes, I did. There was no names exchanged. I was just another guy to him. But I knew he was a general. One morning, I was cleaning my. I had a Downey automatic, DAR, they call them. And I was. He flew in with a little plane, and to meet with the officers. And I was cleaning my weapon. I had a little part of a blanket. I laid all the pieces on. You had to keep them real clean so they weren't. And he come by and he said, "Yep." He says, "You better clean her up pretty good because I think you might need it today," he said to me. So that's, and then we had I had a Lieutenant Johnson. He was in charge of the company I was in.
Now, Merrill's Marauders were dropped behind enemy lines in.
Not dropped.
Oh, you.
We never, one guy said that night, but we weren't dropped. We went by ship over to Bombay, India. We stopped several times. It took us 37 days on the water to get there. Went on the USS Lurline. We got to Bombay. Then we were under the British. Food, rations, everything. We was in a small camp there, Camp Delali, and we took some done some maneuvers there for about, oh, I'd say 5-6 weeks. And then we crossed India on that narrow gauge railroad to Upper Assam. That's at the foothill, at the base of the Himalaya Mountains. That's where they flew from there over the hump, you've heard. And we got there, that's where we got acquainted with our horses, the pack horses and stuff. They come separately. And it was, well, I don't know, we was there maybe a week. And then one night we jumped off, walked. You've heard of the Lidl Road, General Picks Road, they call it, but we call it the Lidl Road. And we walked on that for 100 miles. That was a conditioning hike into Burma. And then from then we went into the jungle. There was no roads, just trails in the jungle. That's all. There was no roads.
And how long were you in that theater?
I was over there. I went in, got over there in about, let's see, I jumped off in, I was about in the Asiatic, let's see, got there in October. End of October, first part of November, and we got out of there in March of 45.
Now, what experiences are most vivid in your memory of serving in the jungle with Merrill's Marauders?
Oh, I got a lot of them.
We'd love to hear them.
Oh, yes. And we was Our 2,800 men, that included your horse leaders, your mule leaders, pack horses, took care of them. That included everybody. So everything had to come out of there. And we broke up into six combat teams with colors. We had, I was in the white column, then it was red, blue, khaki, orange. There was anyway six colors. And each one was equipped to fight his own battle. He had his heavy, the 81 millimeter mortar was the highest, heaviest weapon we had. Then we had machine guns and light mortars, and then just our rifles and BARs. Plenty of grenades.
And what was the primary mission of your unit, its overall general mission during that time?
It was to... See, the Japs had patrols out on all these trails, and you never knew when you was going to see them, run into them. And it was back there, get in the back of them and harass them, search them out. Hit them and run. We hit, and then we'd fly back into the jungle, disappear in the jungle, so they didn't know where we were at, even though they did know sometimes. But we had a lot of firefights on trails. They'd set up a, what you call a trail block. And it's down in trails long like that. Usually they'd set up on a little bit higher ground, and then where they had a view of the trail. As soon as we got in view in that fire zone, then they'd shoot. That was tough. But the only thing good about it was they weren't very good shots. They always usually shot over us with their machine gun. They did.
Now, how was your unit resupplied?
Supplied entirely by air. C-47s parachuted stuff down to us. They parachuted oats. They didn't parachute the oats. They put it in big bags, gunny sacks. They'd pack about 10 pounds in a sack just loosely, and they'd put about 10 of them bags in a great big heavy bag, and they'd kick them out the door, and then come down. See, when it was loose in there, they wouldn't break.
Now, obviously, you didn't have a whole lot of luxuries or amenities out there. I mean, so obviously, supplies were very limited as far as
yes,
what they could get.
I wore the same clothes till it fell off me just about. The same clothes.
Wow.
Shoes, I had jungle boots on. I had them all wore out when I come out of there.
Now, earlier tonight, you mentioned that obviously you couldn't write letters back home due to the nature of your mission.
That's right. We could not get mail out. Couldn't get anything out, see? And that's what worried my folks. They didn't understand it.
Now, how did you get news in, like via radio reports or newspapers? Did they drop in some?
We had them crank a radio. Every column had a crank radio or a generator, and it crank at night. It'd hum and hum, and they could talk out.
Now, you were there until March of 1945. Under what circumstances did your unit leave that theater?
I see the Chinese come in and kind of took over. They come in, followed us down through the jungle. And they got a place where they landed a C-47, and that's where I got on. I handed my BAR, and I had a big Gurkha knife. I handed that right over to a Chinese was standing there. They didn't have no record or anything of nothing. We just handed our guns away.
And then you left from Burma and went to where?
Went back to India. To Calcutta, India. That's where we shipped out from.
What was it like being in the jungle for so long and then getting to a big city like Calcutta, having been relieved?
Oh, it was different. There was lights and stuff there, you know. Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot different.
Where were you when news of the Japanese surrender was announced?
In 45, I got home to my folks' place on July 5th, day after the 4th. And I had a 30-day leave. That took us over to August 6th or 7th. And August 6th is when they dropped that first atomic bomb. I'll never forget. At my folks, it was trashing time, and my uncle, he helped my dad trash, see? And he come up there that one morning, and at my folks' place, we always had to have coffee before we really got started, about 8:30 in the morning. And George was his name, and he didn't come in. He didn't come in the house. He usually come in. And I said, Delmer, you go out and see why George ain't coming. I went out there, and he had an old 35 Ford, a little radio in there, and he was laying over in the seat, ear down to that radio, and all he'd say, God, that must have been a big one. God, that must have been a big one. He was describing that bomb, what it done. Oh, God, he said that had to be big to wipe out that town, Hiroshima. Then a couple of days I had to leave again, and I was on the train going to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. That's where I was supposed to report to, and they dropped the other one. And then when I got to Leonard Wood, they were celebrating down there that Japs had given up.
And the war was over.
The war was over. Then they shipped me on to the Camp Rucker, Alabama. Then I got my discharge down there and came home. But there's some instances about my over there. You know, the more I think about one time I had malaria so bad. Sickness was bad. I even had typhus, but malaria. And we had to make a forced march because one of our battalions got trapped on a hill. Japs were trying to annihilate them. And they hollered for help. We made a forced march for about 2 days in one night to get to them, and I got so sick, and they didn't want, no way to get out, see, there was no way in that deep jungle to get a guy out. I was so sick, I was starting to faint, I felt myself passing out, and we had a 10-minute break, and I went to a medic, and all they could do, they said, you just stay here. They put my pack on a mule, and you just stay here, and I stayed. They went down the trail. There I was alone, sicker than the dog. I went and got a little water out of the stream that was there. Sat there for an hour or two. I thought, how in the heck am I? I lost them, you know. I got up, what you call sucking up your guts. And I started down that trail where that, the only way I could tell is where the hoofs of horses went. And I caught, this was at noon when they left me there, about noon. And I didn't catch them until they bivouacked, and it was just getting dark in that jungle. I was alone. Oh, that was a terrible feeling, because they always said the Japs would let the column go by sometimes and then come in behind them, see? And I was afraid that's what might happen. Boy, I'll never forget that feeling. I could have been doomed there.
Now, behind the lines, what was your daily diet like?
Oh, K rations. One little box like Cracker Jack. Mm-hmm. One said breakfast on, one said dinner, one said supper. And it was just packed in there, little dehydrator stuff for each. And some days we didn't get them because we couldn't get a drop. We was in too dangerous a spot to take a drop. A lot of times we'd get a five-day deal, that'd be 15 boxes. And that was bulky to tie on your pack. But they said, better make it do an extra day because we don't know if we can get another drop very quick.
Now, did you ever have to improvise for food out in the jungle?
Fish. One time we got some fish. And it's a story, but I learned how to make fish cook fish in the jungle. You take this bamboo, it's got sections in. Each section holds water. And you chop it off below one section or both sections, and you have one side just like a bucket. That's like a bucket. You take these fish, you clean them as best you can, take banana leaves and roll them in, and then pack them in that bucket like of a bamboo, and you get several of them. Then you build a fire around, set them up like a bucket would, and you keep that fire going until that green bamboo is just charred, so it's black charred. Then take them out, and pull them out, and your fish is done. It's just like, take your backbone, take it right out, it's cooked.
Now, did you learn that via training, or is that something
no,
you learned?
No, one guy in the outfit knew how to do it. He said, I'll show you how to do that. One guy. Yeah, I don't know where he learned it or anything, but one time we come across a native hut. We happened to stop. Every hour we had a 10-minute break about when we was marching. We stopped. I could see a native hut up there, and they was doing something out there. And they had one of these here big, shallow bowls like that, I'd say, a great big, like a drum. And they were thrashing white rice. They put it in, and then they had a stomper, see. Take the shells off rice, and then they'd blow on it and blow the chaff to one side, and then they had that little rice here. And I bartered with them for some cigarettes. I had a pack of cigarettes, and they gave me about a cup full of rice. I had an old sock I put it in, and I traded them cigarettes for that rice.
Now, how much interaction did you have with the people who lived out there, the natives? Who
that
lived
was
out?
Just about the extent of it, right there. And I was the only one that ventured over there quick.
So your unit really didn't have much interaction. Was that because the local, there wasn't a whole lot of people there?
There wasn't, and when we came, they vanished. They built their huts about 3-4 feet off the ground, see? Bamboo, split bamboo for forest, and then they had thatched roofs like that. And it was so quiet around that hut. In fact, they have a little trench around for the water. I laid in it because we was coming under fire, see? And it was a bullet come went right through the top of that thatched roof. And then you ought to heard them in there. We didn't know there was anybody in there. That was clear, that shack right by us was clear full of people. And they come out of there after that bullet went through. And they had men in there with machine guns or Tommy guns. They were protected. They protected themselves. They got the women in a low spot out there, and the men all got around with their guns pointing out for protection, see, protect the women. You know, they were there, but we didn't know it until that bullet went through that shack.
Now, when you got home, what was the reaction of your family when you finally got home?
Oh, that was, you know, after I had got my discharge from the Army. Well, when I came home that time, I come home in the middle of the night. I had to catch a ride from Yankton out. My folks had no telephone then, and they didn't know I was coming. And when I come home, my 30-day leave. And, you know, my mother cried. She was so happy. Stuff, I made it back. And that was celebrate for a while.
Did you have a chance to write from Calcutta or any way?
Oh, we got the writing later on. And we did get mail in the jungle one time at Christmas time. They dropped our mail. And, you know, that was, everybody got bundles of mail. And we'd get it and go off, be alone. Everybody tried to be alone. I know I got behind a tree there and went through them, a lot of letters to read through and find out things. And that was, you didn't talk to nobody when they was looking at their mail.
That was kind of an unwritten rule of soldiering.
Yeah, it was. Everybody in the same boat.
How do you think the war changed you? What did you see about yourself that was different after your service?
Well, I don't know. I just wanted to be away from people. I didn't want to be around people much. I just didn't. I come home, of course, I came home on my wife's birthday. She didn't knew I was coming after I had my discharge, but I happened to get home. I went over to see her here in Scotland. I lived over here, 20 miles east of here. And come home, but I just knew I wanted to settle down. I didn't want to run around no more.
Looking for some stability then.
Stability and just be quiet. Let me work. I promised myself when I had my face in the dirt over there, shells were coming in. He was just that far from death, being killed. I promised myself I'd never complain about work again. Never. Even if it was just for a nickel a day, I wouldn't complain. That's how I felt, and I come home, we got married, I went to Sioux City, we got a job in the packing house in Sioux City. Couldn't get no living place around here. I tried in Yankton, I get plenty of work. And I went to the veterans there, and they said, go to Sioux City, you have a better chance of getting an apartment down there. They have more turnover, and you can get a job there too, whatever you want. So we went down there for about, I'd say, 6 months. And I went, the union people went on strike. And we came home to my folks. And I told my wife, I don't like it in the packing house. I don't like that. I'm a farmer. That's all I know is farming. And then, of course, the word got out. And anybody that ever heard of a farm for rent or anything, now this was in January of 46. And by God, my old uncle, he heard of 80 acres north of Ballin down there that could probably rent. I went and we rented that, and that was my start.
Delmer Strunk, Scotland, South Dakota, World War II veteran. Thank you for your service to our country. This is Steve Toome for South Dakota Public Broadcasting.